We're starting a new series today, having concluded David, study of David last week. And this morning we're beginning a study of the life of one of the mightiest of all the prophets, the prophet Elijah. Before we get into the study of Elijah, I'd like to do two things. One is to remind ourselves why we are here. Looking at one of the most familiar passages in the New Testament, 2 Timothy 3:16 this week, I was reminded of what Paul had to say about the purpose of teaching. All Scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness, that the man or woman of God may be complete, equipped for every good work. The purpose of teaching, it's profitable, it says, to study the inspired word of God. Now, teaching is designed in order that we might be changed. Teaching is designed in order to change the way we think, in order to change the way we act, in order to change the things that we want. It's designed to change what we are. Now, it can be entertaining. It's supposed to be interesting. It better be accurate. But the principal function of teaching is that we might all be changed. Now, one of the ways God does that is by telling stories. And the Old Testament is fascinating to study, primarily because the stories are told in narrative form through the medium of biography. Someone has said that history is biography, and God obviously agrees with that because He tells many of His great stories and makes many of the great illustrative principles clear to us through the lives of people in the Old Testament. No one's portrait in the Old Testament is painted any more vividly than the portrait of the great prophet Elijah. Let me share with you what two commentators have said about Elijah. F.B. Meyer has said, "It is impossible to exaggerate the prominence given to Elijah in the Jewish mind. At the circumcision of a child, a seat was always placed for him, and at the annual celebration of Passover in the home, wine was placed for him to drink. It was universally believed that he was to come again to announce the advent of the Messiah." And then Alexander White says this, "The prophet Elijah towers like a mountain over all the other prophets in the Old Testament. There is a solitary grandeur about Elijah that is all his own. There is a mystery and an unearthliness about him, a volcanic suddenness and a volcanic violence. He came from God and he went to God. Alas, there is no longer any such man among us." Well, who was this man of God? Who was this mighty prophet who towers even above the great names of others who wore the same mantle that he wore of prophet in the Old Testament? Well, a little background. First, Elijah was active around 850 B.C. Now, you'll recall that David's dates are roughly 1000 B.C. So he is some 100 years or so after the death of David. The first 40 years after the death of David, of course, belonged to the reign of his son Solomon. And then came a period of roughly 60 years in which there were a half dozen kings, and in which period of time the two kingdoms came out of one. You'll recall that having been united under David, the kingdom of Israel broke off from the kingdom of Judah, and Kingdom of Israel became the northern kingdom. The kingdom of Judah became the southern kingdom. If, like me, you've had trouble reading through 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles and wondering what in the world all the references were to Israel and to Judah, a king of Judah and a king of Israel, it may help you to remember, as it does me, that I comes before J in the alphabet. North comes before south on the map, and so IJ, Israel is to the north and Judah is to the south. If that helps you use it, if it doesn't, forget it. And I'll just tell you that it helps. That's the way I remember it. That's how smart I am. At any rate, the northern kingdom of Israel was established in the southern kingdom of Judah. They fought between themselves for years and years, really almost incessant warfare with a few periods of peace until the time that the northern kingdom was carried away into exile. Also, there was warfare between the various factions within the kingdoms themselves. So this became a period of enormous instability and deterioration and degeneration. We're going to look only at the northern kingdom of Israel because that's where Elijah was active. Now, when we last saw this kingdom all in one piece, this is the kind of picture that emerged immediately following the reign of David. These are some of the closing scenes that God paints for us to show the condition of the United Kingdoms under David. David said to the assembly, this is from 1 Chronicles, "Bless the Lord your God, and all the assembly," that means everyone there, this is a picture of the entire nation now, "all the assembly blessed the Lord, the God of their fathers, and bowed their heads and worshiped the Lord." So the kingdoms were not only united politically and geographically, they were united economically, and most importantly, they were united spiritually under a godly king, David. Then this period of deterioration sets in, first 40 years under Solomon, and then the second 60 years that we're going to look at just by way of brief background together this morning as we begin the study of Elijah, because it's important for us to see what his times were like in order for us to appreciate the kind of man that he really was. So we're going to take about 5 or 6 minutes to run through just the kings whose reigns reflected the kind of internal, spiritual, and external geographical collapse that were to be the hallmark of this 60-year period. You won't need to worry about the names of these kings. You'll probably never hear them again, but we'll run through them very briefly by way of background. The first king to rule in the northern kingdom after Solomon was Jeroboam. Jeroboam ruled for 22 years. And if you wanted to know what kind of rule that was, you would turn over to 1 Kings and look at the 13th chapter. And very briefly, I'm just going to go through these. And if you want to try to keep up, that's great. I've already gotten mine marked. And so if you can't, don't feel guilt. 1 Kings 13, 33 and 34 gives us a précis of what kind of rule Solomon's son had. "After this thing, Jeroboam did not turn from his evil way, but made priests for the high places again from among all the people. Any who would, he consecrated to be priests of the high places, and this thing became sin to the house of Jeroboam." Now there's a key phrase there, of course. Priests of the high places means priests of idol worship, because that's where all of the idol worshiping was going on. The high places were the places of Baal. They usually built a temple on the top of a hill. And Jeroboam introduced idol worship into Israel. His was an active promotion of idolatry, deception, and murder. And if you were to read his story in 1 Kings, you would find that to be the case. Now, he was followed by his son Nadab. Nadab had a good long reign of 2 years. And in 1 Kings 15, 26, you have a very brief summary of what kind of reign you could have expected if you'd been in Israel at that time. "He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and walked in the way of his father, and in his sin which he made Israel to sin." That again is Old Testament parlance for idol worship. Well, Nadab, after 2 years, was assassinated by a man named Baasha. And Baasha took over for a period of time, actually a little over 24 years. And he followed a time-honored tradition in the Middle East. He killed everybody who was in the way of his consolidation of rule. And let's see, 15:29 gives us a brief summary there. "Baasha killed in the 3rd year the king of Asa of Judah, reigned in his stead. As soon as he was king, he killed all the house of Jeroboam. Left the house of Jeroboam, not one breathed until he had destroyed it according to the word of the Lord," and so on. So Baasha came in and exterminated all of his predecessor's family and set up a new ruling dynasty, which he, of course, was sure would last throughout all the ages. His son Elah came along and ruled for 2 years and was doing just fine until he made a mistake. He decided that he would go over to a friend's house, a guy named Arza, and have a little blowout. And so he went over and was enjoying himself until the commander of his chariots found out that the king was in his cups. And if you were to look at 1 Kings 16 and verse 9, you would find that his servant Zimri, commander of half of his chariots, conspired against him. When he, that is the king, was at Tirzah, drinking himself drunk in the house of Arza, who was over the household of Tirzah, Zimri came in, struck him down, and killed him in the 24th year, and so on. So he was assassinated. And Zimri, having learned his lesson, was also quick to go in and exterminate all of that royal family. And he set up to rule for a good long time. He lasted exactly 7 days before he himself was overthrown. He burned himself up in his own palace, and he made way for Omri. Omri was a delightful fellow who ruled for 12 years. If you look quickly at 1 Kings 16:25, you would find all you need to know and more about Omri. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, did more evil than any who had ever been before him, for he walked in the way of Jeroboam, and then he says what that way is. He made Israel to sin, provoking the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger by their idols. That recurrent theme, idol worship. Well, he was a third-degree black belt in evil. He was a world's champion sinner. He was worse than any who had ever come before him. You could probably picture Vincent Price playing his role in a little black goatee and a long robe with a permanent leer on his face. And he paved the way, though, for what was to come. When just when you would, having read this, think it couldn't possibly get any worse, it does get worse. Because having grown tired of all this homegrown domestic sin, Israel decided that it was going to import some genuine gold-plated, chrome-surrounded foreign sin. And so they did by elevating Ahab to the kingship, and he, of course, brought in his famous wife, Jezebel. And with Ahab and Jezebel, we come to the moment in history when Elijah is about to step on the scene. Now, in trying to picture who these characters might look like, the only one I could think of in retrospect, having studied a little about Ahab's life, to play his role would be Peter Lorre in his declining years. Do you remember what Peter Lorre looked like? He ballooned to about three times his normal size, and his face completely disappeared in a little squint. And of course, to play his wife Jezebel, you could choose no one better than Cher. Can you imagine little fat Peter Lorre and big tall Cher with long black hair and a long black gown? Quite a combination. Is anybody besides me here old enough to remember a song that Frankie Lane sang back in the 50s called Jezebel? Does anybody remember that? I was thinking about that driving in this morning. Do you remember how that went? Let's see. If ever an angel fell, Jezebel, it was you. Jezebel, it was you. If ever a pair of eyes promised paradise, deceiving me, grieving me, leaving me blue, Jezebel, it was you. I suspect that's the way that Ahab felt about this whole thing when he saw the consequences of having imported Jezebel to be his wife. Because if you could picture the United States after the Civil War, not having concluded in 4 years, but continuing on for 60 years, and instead of men of the character and quality of Abraham Lincoln in the White House, if we had had people like Jesse James and Billy the Kid and Machine Gun Kelly and the Marquis de Sade and Jack the Ripper and Al Capone, and just when things had gotten as bad as you thought they could get, then you bring in Bonnie and Clyde. You'd have an idea about what it was like when Ahab took the throne. Now, a little summary of the kind of reign you can expect from Ahab is contained in also in the book of 1 Kings, also in the 16th chapter. Look at verse 29. Let's read just a couple of verses here together. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, that's down to the south now, remember, Ahab the son of Omri began to reign over Israel, and Ahab the son of Omri reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. Ahab did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all that were before him. And as if it had been a slight thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, he took for wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, went and served Baal and worshipped him. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria, and Ahab made an Asherah. We'll see what that is in a minute. And Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. He did more bad things and made God madder than everybody else put together. Well, you notice, of course, the mention of Jezebel. This is the first time in all of this long litany of kings being mentioned that a woman is mentioned. The reason for that is because Ahab is going to prove to be a genuine royal wimp. He is a zero with the edges shot away, so henpecked the daylight comes through him. Jezebel is going to prove to be an extremely strong character. She herself, probably a demon-possessed person, came to be the person who manipulated and controlled the king. Now, she brought a dowry with her, and her dowry included the worship of the god Baal. She was the daughter of the king of Phoenicia, Sidonia, that's referred to here as Phoenicia. She imported 850 priests with her and began to build temples for all of these priests. Ahab had, of course, violated Mosaic law by having married Jezebel in the first place, because kings were not supposed to go outside of the immediate confines of the Jewish people in order to marry. The worship of Baal was introduced, and you notice that it was not just Jezebel who worshipped Baal, but Ahab himself, and he built an Asherah. Well, let's find out who Baal was and why God won't tolerate idol worship either then or now, and then we'll know what it was that made Elijah the man of the hour. First, Baal. In about 1928, a Syrian farmer along the Mediterranean coast was plowing in his field when he struck what he thought was a rock. He turned the rock over and found beneath the rock a hole. He called for some friends. They began to excavate, and they determined that what they had thought was a hole was actually an enormous underground tomb. Over a period of time, it was determined that this tomb was a part of an enormous complex which over a number of years has been excavated and has proven to be the town of Ungarit, which was a Canaanite town that existed at about the same time that Ahab and Jezebel were working their wills on the people of Israel. Now, as a result of a number of clay tablets which were found, all of them written in seven languages, one of which was Egyptian, and at that time it was possible to, of course, translate the Egyptian writing because of the what had been found much earlier in the Rosetta Stone. Some earlier languages that had not been able to be deciphered were deciphered, and a whole lot of what was unknown about the worship of Baal became known. The name Baal meant master or lord. He was meant to have been the son of El, E-L, the father of all the gods, and Baal had three daughters, and it's important that we note this, for we'll know why in a moment. One of the daughters was the goddess of rain, the other the goddess of dew, and the third was the goddess of the earth. He took, of course, a consort whose name was Asherah, and she is variously reported to be either his wife, his mother, his sister, or his daughter. So you can take your pick, but she was his consort, and she was the goddess of fertility, and also, interestingly, the goddess of war. She was a terrible goddess who slaughtered men in the mythology. She became then a symbol of violent sexual perversion and also the violence of murder. Now, you might expect what would happen when you put Baal, who is the great god of thunder, who has also become the father of the rain and of the earth and so on, together with a picture of fertility and of violence and of murder. You came up with the worship of Baal and Asherah, which was composed of priests and priestesses who were both cult prostitutes and cult homosexuals, who engaged in and encouraged the people to engage in acts so desperately profane and indelicate that they can't be mentioned here. But they also involved terrible acts of sacrifice of infants. In the area of Megiddo, there have recently been excavations which have discovered, among many other things, a large cemetery totally populated with casks, earthenware pots, and in those pots are all remains of babies that were sacrificed to Baal and to Asherah at this period of time. And the ultimate profanation of this kind of worship was that the word in Canaanite for the priests and the priestesses, the high ones of Baal and Asherah was the same word that they used for holy. So a total profanation of worship. Now this is what Jezebel brought with her as a wedding present to the people of Israel. The worship of Baal and of Asherah. Now, as we know from our studies of the Old Testament, Israelites are always going after false gods, and God is always chastising them for it. Now, why is that? Well, we recall that God has said in the first commandment what? That there shall be no other gods besides me, no other gods before me. And then the second commandment is that you shall create no idols, no graven images. Now, God knows a lot of things, but he knows at least two with respect to this matter. The first thing is that man is born to worship. He is created to worship. It's not optional with man. We either worship God or we're going to worship something else. And Paul tells us what that something else is over in 1 Corinthians 10:19. Very interesting how this passage parallels what we're studying this morning. 1 Corinthians 10:19. I'll just read it to you quickly. This is where Paul is talking about meat sacrificed to idols. And he says, "What do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything?" He's saying, we all know that a stone-headed idol or something carved out of wood is nothing. So what's the big deal about idols anyway? And then he tells us in the punchline, verse 20, "No, I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God." They offer to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to be partners with demons. In the Modern Language Bible, Paul says, "I do not want you to have fellowship with demons." It reminds me of Muhammad Ali saying, "I don't want you living with no roaches." Well, Paul is saying the same thing. He is saying that if you worship anything or anyone but God, you're ultimately worshiping Satan. Now, God knows that if we do that, we're going to go back into slavery. You recall how God describes himself in Deuteronomy? He says, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of bondage." God knows that if we worship anyone or anything except himself, we're going to be worshiping Satan. You know, this is one of those places in a passage where you have to stop and think, I wonder how that's relevant today, because we don't see people down on Main Street setting up idols, and yet we know that there is idol worship abroad in the land today. For example, we know that it's possible to worship the idol of your job, or the idol of your status in the community, or the idol of your bank balance, which is less of a problem now for some of us than it was 18 months ago. You can worship your ego. You can worship your reputation. I wonder if last Saturday, today wouldn't be a good day to do it, anybody went out and fell down and washed his idol and polished it and put a little armor all on the wheels and then drove it down and filled it up with... That sounds silly, doesn't it? But we become trapped in those kinds of things. And God says, be very careful. You shall have no other God besides me. Well, that's the background of the appearance, this sudden cataclysmic appearance of the prophet Elijah. You notice he has no genealogy, doesn't say who his mama and daddy were, barely says anything about where he comes from. He suddenly just bursts on the scene in the midst of a long, long decline of the nation of Israel until they have come to the point that they worship in the manner that we've been describing, an absolute profanation of everything that God has been urging upon the people since he brought them forth from the land of Egypt. Now, someone has said, Elijah appeared at 0 hour of Israel's life like a meteor. He flashed across the blackness of Israel's spiritual night. Nobody but Elijah could have confronted the gold dust twins. Jezebel and Ahab were plenty capable of carrying forward their program. Jezebel, again, controlled by Satan. Jezebel controlling Ahab. And they thought they had it by the tail on a downhill pull, because there was nobody who could stand against them. But we're going to see, as we've seen so often together in our studies, that just when man has it all figured out, and just when he has brought everything to a very satisfactory conclusion, he discovers to his shock and his chagrin that he's left one thing out of his calculation. And what he's left out is God. Because when man gets through, God is just beginning. And very frequently, with one mighty blow, God changes entirely the course of history. Let's look as Elijah now steps upon the stage in chapter 17 of 1 Kings. Just a very short reference to him. One verse. Elijah the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, "As the Lord God of Israel lives before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word." Now we're just going to look at three things about Elijah this morning, and then we will flesh those out as we get on into our study in subsequent times together. This sudden appearance of Elijah reminds me of that great Robert W. Service poem. You remember how the poem begins, a bunch of the boys were whooping it up in the Malamute Saloon. The kid that handled the music box was playing a jagtime tune when out of the night, which was 40 below and into the din and glare, there stumbled a miner, fresh from the creek, dog dirty and loaded for bear. That's the way Elijah was. See, he just stumbled in. Can you imagine how that would have been? Here is Ahab and Jezebel, and they've just finished dinner, and they're roasting some marshmallows, and they're planning who they're going to invite to the weekend's orgy. And a servant comes in, and he says, "Excuse me, exalted repugnance, there's a man outside who says that he's got a weather report for you." And Ahab says, "Well, why don't we show him in? We might want to know what the weather's going to be like this weekend. If we don't like him, yeah, we'll always cut off his head." So Elijah comes in and he says, "Friends, I'm shutting off the rain. And nobody but I can start it up again. And I'm getting ready to leave town." And you're going to discover that he does just that for 3 years. Amongst the excavations that were found on these clay tablets is the actual text of the weather report that Elijah brought that morning and that evening. This is what it sounded like. "God has sent me, I am here, just one message, loud and clear. No more trickles, no more drizzles, just the sun dries and sizzles. No more sprinkles, no more dew, till I say I'm through with you. No water for your hot dog weenie, no more ice for your martini. No more bathing, little pinky, best get used to being stinky. You two give the Lord a pain, so he's shutting off the rain." And that's exactly what happened. God shut the rain off for 3 long years while Elijah disappeared from the scene. Well, 3 clues to the character of Elijah, which we'll see worked out over the next several weeks. 1, his name. 2, where he came from. 3, what he said and how he said it. First, his name, Elijah. L-E-L stands for Elohim, which of course means God. The personal pronoun means my or mine, and Jah, J-A-H, we've seen before, of course, is short for Yahweh. So you put those 3 things together and you come up, his name means my God is Jehovah. So when he walked in and said, "I'm Elijah," Ahab understood that what he was saying was, "You may think that Baal is God, and you may think that you are Lord, but I stand only before God and say to you, my God is Jehovah." His very name spoke his character. I wonder if that grabs you the way it did me. You know, we also carry a name that should speak our character, because we call ourselves by the name Christian. Christian. I heard a story the other day about Alexander the Great, who, it says, always held a tribunal every week on a Thursday. He would set up his throne in the middle of the field wherever he was, and he would judge the cases that came before him. This one particular time, he was judging a young man who was accused of cowardice, having hidden behind a rock to shelter himself from the flight of arrows, which sounds like a very sensible thing to me. But he was brought before Alexander, and the young man was in danger of being sentenced to death, of course. Alexander took pity on him and stepped down from his throne and said, "Young man, you're accused of cowardice. Tell me, what is your name?" And the young man looked up from his kneeling position and said, "Sir, my name is Alexander." And Alexander reached down and grabbed him by the front of his tunic and lifted him up and said, "Fella, either change your ways or change your name." I think God says that to us sometimes as Christians. We're to either change our ways or change our name. All of this is designed to cause us to change our ways and to be worthy of the name. Well, that's what his name meant. Elijah, my God is Jehovah. His home was in Tishbe. We don't know very much about that. It says that he is from a region which we know to be to the east of Jordan, which is out in the wilderness area. It was a place that bred really tough, leathery people, not smooth, rounded, polished people. You know who Elijah reminds me of at this stage in his career? I'll bet the same as you. John the Baptist. That same kind of a tough, rough guy who just bursts on the scene, who confronts monarchs who shouldn't be on the throne, who tells them to their face who they are and what they are. Tough, austere, muscular, leathery. It reminded me of a description I heard of John Knox, the great Reformation figure in Scotland. This is what someone said about him. John Knox was a stern man in a stern age, in a rough and violent country. The corruptions by which Christianity was universally disfigured had grown to greater heights in Scotland than in any other nation within the pale of Western Church. Knox's rough road took a rough man to travel it, but he had a tender side. Sometimes when he opened the word, he couldn't speak for the tears. A man of great toughness, great passion, and great tenderness. That's a good description of what Elijah was like. Elijah stepped before the two most powerful people in his human universe and said, I am a man with no family connections, no powerful friends, no one to intercede for me. I stand before God alone, not you, to tell you to your face that 60 years of godlessness is being brought to an end by God Himself. Your wickedness and that of this nation is so great that God is taking the life out of it by shutting off the rain. A rough man whose name was his character, standing alone. You know, I have to confess to you that these kinds of passages really sting me. Someone said the other day that one of the things we have to be careful of is not to take the sting out of Scripture. I just want to share with you that during this past week, as I've been studying this passage, I've been stung more than once by this because I've got some questions that emerge for me that I'd like to share with you. I wonder if we, like Elijah, are willing to stand alone in our day for Christ. Do we run the risk of blending into the landscape, of being so like the pagan world around us that you can't tell us from that world? Do we run the risk of becoming Christian chameleons who, for the sake of getting along and going along, modify our behavior and who we are to the point that you can't tell us from those around us? For example, do we allow our television sets to pump the sewage of pornography right into our homes? Do we allow false teachers to warp the minds of our children? Do we allow ourselves to debate social issues in church instead of preaching the gospel? I thank God that we have a godly pastor here who preaches the gospel from the pulpit. Do our personal standards of morality become so compromised that we're no longer role models even for our own kids? I think that those are real risks. For those young people who are here, who are in school, have you come to the place that you're able to say no because of following Christ and have that no be a gracious witness for Christ so that you're not a freak, but you're unique? Young people need to develop the capacity to do that. In business, under these kinds of pressures that we all operate under, anyone who's in business in Houston today is operating under terrific pressure. I wonder if we wink and blur edges and cut corners and stretch the truth until the truth becomes a lie. It's very tempting to do that. Marcia and I were invited to dinner the other night, and we already had some plans, and so I just said, sorry, we can't come. We're committed. And after I hung up the phone and turned around, I said, we're committed. What a powerful phrase that is. Have you come to the place in your Christian life that you're able to simply say, we're committed? We're committed to the life of the Lord Jesus Christ. He's real in our lives, and here is where we stand. Ezekiel 22:30 has a marvelous way of phrasing this. This is God speaking. I sought for a man among them, or a woman, who should build up the wall and stand in the breach before me for this land, that I should not destroy it. And then four terrible words from God's lips. Having said I sought for a man or a woman, he says, but I found none. No one to stand for me. God is looking for men and women today whose hearts, like Elijah's, are totally committed to His. I was thinking just how you do when you're trying to picture things. If God were to come this morning and walk up and down the aisles of just this gymnasium, looking into every face, would He look and say, yes, there's one, there's one, there's another, there's another? Looking into the soul and seeing the kind of a committed heart, the kind of life, He would say, that I need, sufficiently committed to stand alone for me against the Ahabs of today. I wonder if your Christian walk and mine has brought us to the place that our love of Christ has put commitment in our soul and steel in our backbone, to the place that we're willing to stand like Elijah was willing to stand. Well, I suspect that God can't make much use of chameleon Christians, but He can make use of another kind. I heard a marvelous story this past week from a friend about a little girl, maybe 5 or 6, just a little tyke, who said to her mother, what does it mean really to be a Christian? And she explained to her what it was, and included in that, she said, Christ comes into you and lives inside of you in the most marvelous way. And she said, Mama, how tall was Jesus? And she said, well, I don't know, maybe 5'10", maybe 6 feet. And she looked down at her little body and she said, He's going to stick out. Isn't that great theology? That's exactly it. He's supposed to stick out. You know what God says? I want to attract people to you and make you a unique individual in this time and in this place. And for that, you need to be like Elijah, totally committed to me, standing alone in the breach, letting Christ stick out, show through you in your life so that people can see my glory, who I am. And I couldn't help thinking about that marvelous passage in Elijah in Isaiah, where God said to Isaiah, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And I said, here am I. Send me. Let's thank Him. Father, this morning we thank You for the life of a man like Elijah, someone who in some ways seems beyond our reach, but at the same time, as we're going to see, a man very much like us who had totally turned his life over to God and therefore became someone whom God could use to stand in the breach all alone for Him at a particular time in a particular place. We know You're looking for people like that, committed lives, Father. Help us through Your grace to have that kind of commitment in our day. In Jesus' precious name, amen.